$10,000. This is an interview with John W. Cranston. The interviewer is Betsy Brinson, and it takes place in the Patton Museum in Fort Knox, Kentucky. Well, thank you, John, for being willing to talk with me today. Tell me first, give me your full name and birthplace and birth date.
Well, let's see, John Welch Cranston, and I was born in Utica, New York on December 21st, 1931, because there was no hospital in Hamilton, and my father was a college professor at Colgate.
Okay, and Welch is
W-E-L-C-H. Okay. Same for my mother's side of the family.
Well, thank you for agreeing to meet with me today to talk a little bit about Margaret Collier and the integration of troops here at Fort Knox in the military. It's nice to talk to you because you certainly are a very credentialed historian. I note from your materials that you have your PhD in history from the University of Wisconsin. You also did some graduate work at Columbia University. What brought you to Fort Knox, and how long have you been here?
Well, first of all, I retired from Fort Knox in 1995, in July 14th. I got there in December 1983. I had taught at a predominantly black college in Mississippi, 30 miles north of University of Mississippi and 30 miles south of Elvis Presley country in Memphis.
And which college was that?
Rust, R-U-S-T. Okay. It's predominantly black, named like Fisk for a Reconstruction figure. And 1866, I think they were both founded the same year. And the truth was that the head of TRADOC, who was then General William R. Richardson, had decided if we had more civilian historians, we would not have Vietnams. And so each TRADOC post, I've forgotten how many we have, 17 or something like that, each one got a civilian historian. A lot of them happened to be, like me, German historians, and a disproportionate number came out of Midwestern universities.
So you came here as the, what was your official title?
For Armour Center historian.
Historian, okay. And what were your responsibilities?
Oh, right, the command history every year, and then I also put columns in the newspaper, The Turret, and interviewed a number of people, kept a number of the documents that came into circulation, and served briefly with an NCO instructor in the Armor School.
Okay. And I believe you yourself actually spent a few years in 1952, 3 in the military?
Yes, I went with basic training at Fort Ord. That would have been September 21st, 1953, and then went over to Germany, I guess, in March 54. And got out of the Army in August 55, and as of...
When were you in Germany?
I was there from March in Augsburg, from March until March 54, till February 55, and then in Schweinfurt and Würzburg from March 55 till I got out in July.
The reason I ask you that is I actually... I come from a long generation of military, and my father was stationed in Heidelberg during those same years, so I was living there also.
As of August 8th, I'm going back again, and my Delta frequent flyer came through.
Right.
So
well,
Würzburg I will see again. All the other places are in East Germany, including Berlin, and those will be new to me that I got back here about August 21st.
Okay. How did you come to be involved in telling the story of Margaret Collier?
I think somebody just suggested here at Fort Knox we should interview her, and I think the person who suggested it is still around, and I think that was Shelby Roberts, who was the assistant G3, and John Purdy would have his phone number, because he's now head of essentially post-security. and he was, he would have been deputy G3, and I think he suggested it, and as John Purdy will confirm, he served with her on the Cavalry Armor Foundation and knew her. And I think it was his suggestion, and so we interviewed her. She, by the way, never approved the interview.
She saw it and disapproved?
She saw it. She never approved of any of it. The truth was that she wanted very much to write up what she did and be compensated for it. Mm-hmm. The Center of Military History was always interested, but no money. Mm-hmm. And so there it sat. So what you're dealing with is essentially an unapproved interview, mm-hmm. and it's all that we have on her.
Mm-hmm. I've looked very quickly mm-hmm. through some of the boxes of archives mm-hmm. here and note that she herself attempted several drafts of a
she did.
Autobiography.
She worked with Phyllis Kassler, who had Candace's job there. And the issue of money came up, and Phyllis did everything she could, and as John Purdy will confirm, they were not successful in getting the thing. So there apparently is a good deal that she wrote and has stayed with the museum.
I'm interested in why she felt she needed the money when she herself had lived frugally, but I understand that she she gave scholarships to young people to attend
I didn't know
college.
Much about that.
And I wonder if maybe part of her interest in having the money come in would be to help her to continue to do that work.
That could very well have been. I could not answer that question. I didn't know her particular financial situation. I gather that, like many military people, she felt she had to watch the money. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure how well she was physically at the end.
Mm-hmm. She was about what age when you interviewed her?
I really don't know. By then she would have retired. Does one retire in that position? Maybe 65. I would have said she was older than 65. It may be in the interview she says something.
It may be, but you interviewed her in 1986.
1986,
That's okay, I can...
Yeah, I would say she was almost certainly above the age of 65.
Okay.
And she would have been retired by then. I think she was living in Bowling Green.
Okay. What can you recall about her, just her physical appearance?
Oh, she...
Did you know her... or have interaction with her at any other time besides this interview?
No, I knew really much less about her than would either Shelby Roberts or John Purdy.
Okay.
And I think probably I was able to communicate with her because I taught in a predominantly black institution.
Okay.
But that was quite truthful, yeah.
Okay. Tell me about her physical appearance.
She seemed in good physical shape.
Or...
I would have said she was less than 6 feet tall, or probably about a medium build. I think at that time she could drive a car back and forth here from Bowling Green. I think she was in pretty good shape.
Okay.
She had no trouble seeing where she was going or hearing what she was doing.
Okay. And you've graciously provided me a copy of mm-hmm. the interview and the transcript. How did you see that as an interview with her? Was she quite open in answering your questions?
Well, she was a forthright in what she had to say. I think she was rather modest about her role here. I think she took great delight particularly in explaining what she did. When life around here must have been kind of difficult. I grew up in California. Wisconsin is a very different ball game from here. I think there must have been racial segregation in Louisville in the 50s. My understanding was there were separate schools. I think she had a hard fight on her hands. I also think she got a lot of support even before civil rights from the general officers in charge.
Mr. Purdy and I were talking earlier, off tape actually, about conjecture as much as anything about why she never married.
I think she was just devoted to Fort Knox and what she was doing, and I think also at that time, how many eligible black officers, and I think it would have been an officer, would have been on hand. When I was in the Army, 53 to 55, at Fort Ord, you began to see black lieutenants and captains. When I got out, you began to see black majors. But in that environment, you were not seeing lieutenant colonels or colonels, and this would be the kind of person that she would have worked with, but they weren't on hand in that difficult period.
In addition to Margaret Colley, I'm going to move from that, but as the historian here, what can you tell me about the integration of blacks into the military here at Fort Knox?
Well, I got here in 83, and by that time, I think integration had been fully accomplished on post, I think in part because of what she had done. We also have had our first African-American commanding general, General Jordan, who left here, I've forgotten, I guess 4 years ago, 1996. And I think partly because of where we are located, integration has gone well. I notice where I live in Radcliffe, you have African-Americans living right next door to whites. I think probably, although he may not have intended it, much of that began under Richard Nixon, who gave NCOs enough money so that they could go buy houses off post. That led to the growth of Radcliffe. And integration more or less came about just because it didn't matter whether you were an African American or a white, you had enough money to buy a house, and Radcliffe moved along. And,
was Radcliffe there before that period?
I don't think as much there. If you look around Radcliffe, I know my house was built in 1977, and then they built around it since then. I moved into it in 1985, and well, let's see, what have we got? Richard Nixon is out of office in August of 1974. It is under that period that Radcliffe, I'm sure, began to develop, and if you look around at the houses, they look as if they were built during the Nixon.
Is Radcliffe a pretty multiracial neighborhood?
I think they're pretty much multiracial, and it would look to me as if a lot of the houses went up in late 60s, early 70s. Credit Richard Nixon with a good deal of that.
Are the neighborhoods actually integrated within Radcliffe?
I would say the neighborhoods are very well integrated, as are the schools.
Right. Okay.
And I think that maybe Richard Nixon hadn't intended that. I know I was teaching at Rust College, and under him, federal money went up rather than down.
Okay. I wonder, though, as the base historian, if you have any recollection of what transpired here in the 40s.
I really would not have much of any idea. I have noted down there a couple of books that might say a few things. Stephen Ambrose wrote a book called Soldiers, and
right.
I've forgotten if he said anything about that. I know he goes after the Army method of replacement, says we didn't do as well as the Germans did.
But he wouldn't have talked specifically about Fort Knox.
No, he would not have. And then I put down Charles McDonald, who I think says quite a lot, but I tread there carefully because I have forgotten. He says quite a lot as I recollect, about how African Americans were used in the Battle of the Bulge. And since they used tanks and Fort Knox was training people with tanks, it would have been involved. But except for the exhibit, which I noticed shows at the officer level that they were training African Americans along with whites, I wouldn't be able to say much more than that. With basic training, I suspect you had black companies with white officers, but I'm not sure. And then you had integrated companies, and I can remember when I was overseas in February 54, there was a tendency in Augsburg to have the integration take place in your heavy weapons companies first. That's because I was in Company H, and they were gradually integrating the rifle companies, but Company H and Company D and whatever it was beyond that, L, M, probably M, that was where integration came first.
The experience, as I understand it, here at Fort Knox from the museum exhibit, though, is that the African-American soldiers who were trained here were initially trained separately, and then they were trained in an integrated fashion. But when they were assigned to duty after their training, in the early years at least, they were assigned to segregated units.
That could have been.
Is that correct?
I don't know the story. I do know that we have listed there, what is it, the 761st Tank Battalion from World War II. Next to it, I think, is the 751st, and then there's another. And those were segregated, according to the exhibit there. Mm-hmm. And according to the film Liberators, which got into so much trouble, but that's an example of
where. Well, tell me about that film. And how does that connect to Fort Knox?
Well, I don't think it connects too much, except that it would depend on where the unit trained. And the book is over in the Barr Library, and almost certainly it would be. You wouldn't have any trouble finding it at the UK library.
What's the story that the library
Well, the
tells?
Thing that got it into trouble was that there were no historians involved officially in the film. And they had the, I think it is 761st, liberating concentration camps that they didn't liberate. And that made the units mad that had liberated, which were not black tank battalions. So this set back the cause. There has been a book written about the 761st since that time. I saw it in the Barr Library and just skimmed it. And the New York Times did contact, at least they phoned me, I don't know whether from New York or from here. They were trying to find some nice things to say as well.
What can you tell me about the black battalions that and the concentration camp?
Well, nothing other more than the exhibit here, except that the book, which is available, the book, The Tone Liberators, indicates what was there. I do not think, someone had told me, and I've not read it that closely, that they credit themselves with liberating Auschwitz. I doubt that, because I think the Soviets got there at that end before we did. I think Buchenwald is the unit that was involved, but I'd have to go back and look very carefully. And they did not liberate Buchenwald. And apparently the title of the book was misleading, and what had happened was that the people who wrote it went, well, we think such and such happened there, and they didn't look at the documents. This is a little like at Fort Knox. Periodically, the theory is General Rommel came to Fort Knox. Somebody will say that to somebody else, and every new general here gets excited. We've never found documentation to prove that any of these people ever came. This is the fault of oral history, and it led that particular film into all sorts of trouble.
Did the black battalions liberate any of the camps that you
were with? That I'd have to refer somebody to the books themselves. I've not gotten that involved in it. I think everyone kind of shied off as a hot potato the whole issue from that. Fort Knox played a minor role in finding out the problems with the book.
Where else during the war were black troops trained?
I really don't know. I suppose all over the country in basic training installations.
So Fort Knox wasn't especially unique?
No, it would not have been. I would suspect since there were fewer blacks outside the South, that there may have been more places in the South than in other parts of the country. And then by the time the Korean War began, you had migrations all over the country and a more even spread.
Okay. Have you had any other involvement or done any other research on this topic?
Not really, no.
Okay. What is your pet area of historical?
Well, since it was German history, I'm going back this summer. And the other thing is that I want to write on university architecture of three particular places. One is Dartmouth, one is Pomona, where I went. The other is Carleton in Minnesota, which I'm familiar with. Mm-hmm. And that's a kind of a different field.
And so today you've retired as historian here at Fort Knox.
I have not been employed by Fort Knox since the middle of July 1995.
Okay. But you're teaching at the
Elizabethtown Community College, and then I also work as test examiner.
Okay. All right. Is there anything else you'd like to add to
that? No. I would simply hold up, again, as I mentioned, don't fall into the liberator's trap.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Cranston, for talking with me today.
Oh, yes, they have a very fine German historian there, Conrad Jarosch, teaches there, who succeeded a man named Snell, who died of a tragic illness. Mm. And Jarosch finished at Wisconsin, and I suppose he'll be at North Carolina the rest of his life because it's such a nice place.
Right. Thank you very much, Dr.
An old buddy.